You're listening to the Sex and Psychology Podcast, the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Lehmiller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. In the previous episode, we talked all about how living in a time of unparalleled digital surveillance poses risks to women who are seeking to end a pregnancy and to pursue certain types of reproductive health care. It is becoming increasingly hard for women to pursue abortion due to state laws that restrict or ban it. This has led some to seek care in other states where services are legally available, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're free and clear to do so. Arranging care in other states leaves a number of digital traces that law enforcement and bounty hunters can potentially uncover. So in today's episode, we're going to focus on ways in which people can mitigate the risks of data surveillance and keep their personal information more secure. This conversation has broad relevance to anyone looking to increase privacy in the digital era. We're also going to explore what technology companies need to be doing to keep our information secure, how laws need to change to better protect us, and how healthcare providers can better protect patient privacy. I am joined once again by Albert Voxcon. He is founder and executive director of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, also known as STOP. He is a practitioner in residence at NYU Law School's Information Law Institute and a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy and Yale Law School's Information Society Project. As a lawyer, technologist, and activist, Albert has become a leading voice on how to govern and build the technologies of the future. He started STOP with the belief that local surveillance is an unprecedented threat to public safety, equity, and democracy. This is going to be a fascinating and important conversation. Stick around, and we're going to jump in right after the break. In every long-term relationship, partners aren't always going to be on the same page about sex. That's normal. But sometimes our sex drives get really out of sync, which can lead to bigger relationship issues. If you're looking for help navigating a situation like this, check out Beducated. They have an amazing library of online courses, including one on mismatched sex drives. This course will help you to better understand the difference between sexual desire and sex drive, tips for dealing with discrepant libidos, ways to improve sexual communication, and so much more. It's full of practical guidelines to help you and your partner get your sex life back on track. The content is created by experts, and there's so much to learn. Try all of Beducated's courses today for free, and if you like what you see, you can get 40% off the yearly pass by using my last name, Lehmiller, as the coupon code. There's also a 14-day money-back guarantee. Check the show notes for the link, and be sure to use my last name to get your discount. Enjoy. If you love the science of sex as much as I do, consider becoming a friend of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. The Kinsey Institute is the world's premier research organization on sex and relationships, and you can help them continue the legacy of Dr. Alfred Kinsey, whose pioneering research changed everything we think we know about sex. Visit kinseyinstitute.org to make an impact. Your donations can help support ongoing research projects on critical topics. You can also show your support by following Kinsey Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for supporting Sex Science. Okay, Albert, in the previous episode, we talked all about various forms of surveillance that are being used and could potentially be used to track people and that are creating barriers and roadblocks to accessing reproductive health care and gender-affirming care. So let's talk about ways of mitigating these risks so that people can protect their privacy and access the kinds of care that they choose for themselves. So let's start at the individual level. You know, short of governments changing laws and companies changing their policies, there's only so much that we as individuals can do, but there are steps that we can take to increase privacy and security for our personal information. So what are some practical ways individuals can keep their data more secure?
Yeah, so last time I talked about threat modeling, and I want to go into a bit more detail about what that can look like. So when I think about a threat modeling exercise, I'm trying to think about every single aspect of my electronic identity, all the data that's stored locally on my computer, on my phone, on my, you know, internet-enabled devices that are increasingly sort of embedding sensors in every part of my life. But I also want to think about the information that is stored in the cloud, the data that's held, you know, ostensibly only for me, but which is oftentimes available to lots of companies as well. And then all the data that's on more public platforms like social media. And you really want to think through systematically with each bucket of data that you are collecting. Is this a bucket of data that you need? Is this a bucket of data that you want? Is this a bucket of data that, you know, you can do without? And also, what are the risks associated? So, for example, I'm a long distance runner and I love to just have good data on how fast am I running? What routes have I run? But I generally refuse to use apps like Strava that a lot of my running friends use because it means, you know, exposing a lot of data potentially about where I live, where I work, where I go, and also just my routines when I'm in the house, when I'm out of the house. And for me, it's not a particularly acute risk, but we've seen examples of where it can be highly problematic. So a few years ago, the military and intelligence community got really, really annoyed at Strava because Strava had heat maps where you wouldn't see individual data, but you would see anonymized data, in quotes, or de-identified data, as we often call it, where it didn't have people's individual running routes, but it would show hotspots where lots of people were running. And guess where there happened to be a lot of physical fitness people? On military bases and intelligence bases, even those that aren't on maps. And so the locations of a lot of classified military outposts got revealed because people were just putting this data on Strava and had embedded in there a little option that, oh, yes, you can use this in the aggregate to show where hotspots are. You know, I am a lawyer. I am a law professor. I am someone who is very expert in this. I can't even go through all of the privacy settings of all of these apps. I can't make sense of the terms and conditions half the time. So I tend to just take a very broad bucket approach of saying, if this isn't data that I really, really need, I'm going to err on the side of caution and just scrap it completely. And, you know, this is something that you can apply to, you know, really all the information you're putting out on social media. If you're telling people that you're on vacation, well, that also means that no one's in your home and people can break in and you're not going to know it. This is something that has happened in cases in the past. If you're putting information about your health out on these various apps, that's something that can potentially be weaponized as well. Though I want to point out that we're very cautious about the whole call to delete period trackers and other femtech apps, because we've seen that as a bit of an overreaction to just one part of the broader surveillance landscape for abortion and gender-affirming care. So we tend to be much more focused on sort of things that reveal location data, things that reveal your communications. And then, you know, the other thing that I tend to think is very helpful with, you know, my own threat model and response, moving more and more of my conversations to encrypted platforms like Signal and setting up Signal to delete those messages automatically. Because really, to the extent that you're making your communications encrypted by default and you're making them time limited, it really reduces your potential threat profile, what people call your attack surface, in the event that your devices are compromised. Because if you've been texting people for years and all of that's searchable and all of that's stored, that can be convenient, but that also can be deeply, deeply compromising. So, you know, really just going through evaluating all those different types of data, thinking about the stuff you can do without, and also just thinking about the stuff where there's a more privacy protective alternative, like with the encrypted messaging.
Yeah, I think that's all great information. And I was going to ask specifically about apps, but I think you covered that well. I hadn't heard the part about apps revealing military base location. And that's just like a fascinating unintended side effect of this increasing presence of technology in our daily lives. We don't always know all of the implications that it's going to have until it's too late. And that's why we need to be thinking about these things as we're developing the technologies. I wanted to ask one other technological question here, because I think it's really important in talking about how to stay safe online. Because in the previous episode, you were talking about how Google searches and other things that we type online can be weaponized against us. So I wanted to ask about your thoughts on using VPNs as a way of kind of protecting your information further when you're just generally out there on the internet.
Yeah. So when we think about going online, when you think about all the ways you're being tracked, it gets really scary really quickly. There's probably no country on the planet that has ever had the level of authoritarian surveillance that is embedded in basically every web browser that exists. When we're thinking about how to protect our web activity, there are a couple of steps you can take. So a VPN can be helpful in mitigating the tracking risk, because whenever you go online, you basically have an IP address, which is, you know, the way that the computers you're talking with know how to get information to you. It's your phone number, your postal address, however you want to think about it. The problem is that a lot of commercial VPNs are really awful and scrape a lot of data and then sell that data. And so you may be hiding your information from the people on the opposite end of that transaction, or maybe it, depending on the circumstances, maybe hiding it from the person operating the network you're using. But that doesn't always mean safety. There's a lot of different debates about which VPNs are best. Rather than endorsing any specific one, I tend to, you know, emphasize the need for VPNs that do not keep logs, preferably those based in countries like Switzerland that have very strong data privacy laws, and really just doing a bit of due diligence and not just assuming that if you're using a VPN, you're safe. Additionally, Tor, the Onion router, provides a lot of protection on top of existing VPNs. So with a VPN, you basically have one server between you and the person you're talking to. With Tor, you have three. And the way it's designed, it's supposed to make it impossible for any of those servers in the middle to fully compromise your online activity, because, you know, one person sees your IP address, one person sees the IP address just of the two other Tor servers, and one just sees the address that you're communicating with. Again, nothing's perfect, but it can be a helpful step, and you can combine the two. Additionally, though, there are other ways to track people besides just their IP address. Browser fingerprinting is another method. So almost every aspect of your computer in a traditional web browser is basically giving away a part of your identity. So the resolution of your screen, what fonts are installed, what keyboards are installed, what languages are installed, all of those types of data points help narrow down your identity. And traditionally, the vast majority of browsers have been very easy to fingerprint. What we've seen is that, you know, the Tor browser, Brave browser, and a few other browsers have started to build in this sort of fingerprinting prevention that will help make it harder to identify your data if you're using that browser. And additionally, we see Privacy Badger and a number of other add-ons for browsers that will limit the ways that your identity is tracked using cookies and third-party trackers. All of these things can mitigate the risk, but none of them are 100%. And so again, you know, to the extent that we build encryption into our default reality for how we navigate the world and make it a bit harder for the companies and governments around us to track our activity, that's only helpful. But even if you're using Tor, even if you're using a VPN, even if you're using all these things, you should never assume that anything you're doing online is 100% anonymous. And additionally, you know, there are useful guides from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and from Mozilla that give step-by-step guides on how you can optimize your settings on a number of platforms like Facebook and Google to mitigate the amount of tracking you'll see through them. But still, unless you're buying a brand new air-gapped computer in cash from a company that has no consumer tracking, there's probably going to be some level of tracking for your internet activity.
Yeah, and what you said, part of it is something I've done recently, which is to go through basically all of my apps and to say, do they really need this kind of access? Like, for example, does Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, do they need access to my entire camera roll at all times? Do they need access to my microphone at all times? Hell no. Right? So, you know, I've started changing my access settings on all of these different apps and things. And I think it's a good idea as an additional layer of protection, limiting how much of that information you're putting out there. Now, in the previous episode, you gave some great advice in terms of talking about traveling out of state to access legally available care that might not be available in your home state. And you talked about how, you know, taking a municipal bus and paying in cash is probably one of the more anonymous ways to go. But, you know, this is something I've been thinking about recently is, you know, I don't think many of us have given a lot of thought to all of the ways that we're being tracked in everyday life and the implications that that might have for us traveling somewhere to, say, access care. So, for example, your car, if it's got a computerized GPS system in it, is collecting data on you. If you have your phone with you, you know, I know every time I go down and get in my car in our basement parking garage that my Google Maps wants to give me a suggestion on where it thinks I'm going to go and how long it's going to take me to get there. And I don't like it knowing that much information about me. So what are some other things people can do when they're traveling or things that they should think about in terms of how they can maintain more privacy around their activities?
Yeah, we had a report on automotive surveillance called Wiretap on Wheels, and it just went through all the ways that police can access telemetrics data and other data from cars. And when Consumer Reports did a study of cars and their privacy policies, it found all of them failed. So, you know, cars are increasingly difficult to use in a privacy protective way. We also see a lot of issues with mass transit systems increasingly making it harder to use cash and using fare payment systems that are linked to a credit card and linked to your ID, which again make it hard. But, you know, there's just a constellation of surveillance systems that permeate modern life, you know, not just the devices and trackers we carry on us, like our phones, like the cars, but things like facial recognition, things like automated license plate readers, things like the EasyPass fare payment systems that all are collecting our data without any real legal guardrails. And that's why part of what we do at Stop is try to fight for laws that limit the extent to which these sorts of tools and data points can become policing tools. So, you know, part of the solution is really, like you were saying, thinking through all of the data we're giving away and trying to mitigate that where you can, trying to uninstall the apps where you can, assuming that any app you're not paying for is making money by essentially selling information about you, and assuming the same thing about all of the services in our cars and other internet-enabled devices. I mean, this is one of those things where I'm constantly disappointing my friends because, like, anytime I'm buying a home appliance, I'm buying the dumbest version with as few sensors and without the Wi-Fi enabled doodad because it, you know, maybe it is not as good at making a app enabled Frappuccino or, you know, there was a new refrigerator I was looking at that integrated to your phone as well. But anytime you're doing that, you're creating a new potential piece of vulnerability for how your life is being tracked. And that definitely goes for all of the quote-unquote smart speakers that embed systems like Alexa into those devices and then, you know, effectively create a wiretap in the making in the middle of your living room. Because, you know, we've already seen cases where police will go to Amazon with a court order and get information from that smart speaker. Or if you have a Ring surveillance camera, guess what? Even if you don't want to give that information over to the police, you know, we still see Amazon handing it over when they get that warrant. So really trying to minimize the amount of data that's being collected as part of your life where you have that control is for me, one of the best steps you can take.
Yeah. And as you were talking about all of that, I was just thinking about how next to impossible it is to travel anonymously. You know, if you're taking an Uber, that's through an app that has a record of where you went and how you paid and the time you got there and the time you left and all of that information. If you take a rideshare, even like a scooter, right, you're creating this digital trace. If you take a taxi and you pay with credit card, like if you check into a hotel or an Airbnb, you know, there are records of all of this. They're not that hard to uncover. And it doesn't really matter what it is that you're doing. If you're going and seeking healthcare, if you're going to a strip club, if you're doing something else, like there are records of all of these things. And I don't think we've really grappled yet as a society with what the implications are of having all of this data out there. So lots of things to think about here.
There are still ways to oftentimes pay for cash, but what is becoming so scary is how hard it is to do it and what a premium you have to pay oftentimes to take the privacy preserving route. And with a lot of these different systems, you don't only have to worry about, well, is the scooter company going to get a warrant from the government? You know, in a lot of locations, like in Los Angeles, every scooter has to give real-time GPS data to the Department of Transportation. That all goes into a massive database. Same with a lot of the rideshare information here in New York. That all goes to the Taxi and Limousine Commission. So you see all of these municipal laws that are adding even more government data collection on top of the corporate data collection, all with ostensibly good purposes of like figuring out how to navigate traffic decisions in the coming years. But it poses a huge threat to our ability to protest, our ability to, you know, live our lives on our own terms. And really, there are a lot of people who hear this and they instinctively say, well, you know, I haven't done anything wrong, so why should I care? And you just have to look at the examples of the individual police officers, the individual government employees who use these databases to settle grudges, who wiretap, you know, ex-boyfriends and ex-girlfriends, who monitor their kids using government surveillance, who, you know, take out a grudge on a neighbor and settle a score that way. You know, this is the sort of abuse that we've seen in authoritarian governments throughout history, that it's not just the ominous authority of the state, it's the potential for individuals to abuse the power that they have. And when you have this sort of surveillance landscape, I don't want to worry that if I get into a disagreement with my neighbor and they work for the NYPD or they work for, you know, the state tax authority, that they'll have this power just to destroy my life and retaliate against me and invade my privacy because they dislike me. And yet that is the reality we see, where thousands and thousands of officers every year are getting disciplined for breaking the rules, breaking the law, and surveilling people they shouldn't.
Yeah, I think that's all really well said. And just so many different things to think about here. But I think it's all about the trade-offs. You know, there are some good things that come out of all of this data being out there. You know, for example, with rideshare apps, we know that in the past that some people have been abducted or have been sexually assaulted by their rideshare driver. And so, you know, having these data on where they are at all times, you know, can be helpful in a criminal investigation. And, you know, having that data can be helpful in figuring out best traffic flow and all that other stuff. But what's the potential for abuse of that data as well? You know, with all of these things, there's always a trade-off. Now, we've talked about some things that we as individuals can do to protect privacy. Let's talk a little bit about healthcare providers and what they can do to make patient privacy more of a priority. And this goes way beyond just complying with HIPAA laws. So what steps can providers take to protect patients and clients, or to at least ensure that their patients or clients are aware of what data they're putting out there that might be subject to government surveillance?
Yeah, HIPAA isn't a privacy law. It's a health portability law, and it ultimately does nothing to prevent law enforcement access to data. So under HIPAA, which, by the way, most modern medical devices, modern medical platforms, most apps, they aren't even covered by HIPAA. HIPAA really only applies to the providers. And when it does apply, it just says, well, you can't give that information to police unless they have a subpoena. Or a warrant. And a subpoena is a bar so low you can't even trip over it. It just requires the information to be relevant to an investigation. And relevance basically is as broad a standard as there is under the law. So what I tend to tell providers is that they really have to start to think about how they can harden their data systems to protect their patients, which means if you're setting up a website, making sure that you're not setting it up with all of this surveillance capitalism that is built into a lot of web hosting platforms. You know, we've seen a number of major abortion providers being criticized in the past for failing to prevent those sorts of trackers from being embedded in their site. There was a really scandalous finding, I believe last year, where a reporter was able to buy a list of basically every visitor to a major abortion provider's website for, you know, just a couple hundred bucks, because there was so much embedded ad tech. So if you're a healthcare provider, stripping away that ad tech, making sure you aren't leaking this information to third parties, and then really thinking through, well, obviously there are state ethics requirements and other requirements for documenting how you give care, but you have to think creatively about where are the places you can limit the documents you're creating, with the assumption that it's not going to be that long before we see more and more doctors getting warrants to hand over their records about, you know, their patients from jurisdictions that are still criminalizing abortion.
Yeah. Let's talk briefly about the big tech companies who are enabling all of the surveillance through the vast amounts of digital data collected on our computers, our phones, and as we mentioned, even our cars. What responsibility do tech companies have when it comes to protecting consumer data? And what changes do you want to see when it comes to their policies or technologies to increase protection?
Well, I mean, the big tech companies could end so much of this today if they just decided to. So geofence warrants only exist because companies choose to store their data in a way where they can actually comply with the warrant. Apple gets a ton of geofence warrants every year. They reply to zero of them because they simply do not have data about our locations in a way they can comply with a geofence warrant. Now, I'll put a pin in that because they do keep a ton of our geolocation data, and there's a lot Apple can do. But, you know, if Google wanted to, they could simply stop keeping our location data in what they call their sensor vault, a database that's used for these geofence warrants. And if they chose to do that, this would stop being a problem for Google users right away. And they, you know, half-heartedly tried to do this just by redacting the location data for abortion clinics. But, you know, really for me, if they are serious about protecting their users from this harm, they'll take the economic hit of not being able to sell our location data to as many advertisers and actually stop keeping that data. But unfortunately, they haven't. For companies like Uber and Lyft, they could actually adjust their back end, how they are storing a lot of this location data, so they don't have the ability to comply with a geofence warrant. You know, again, this only is possible because companies have set up their databases in a way where they can query it through a geofence interface. And if they chose to, you know, segment our data by users and limit the ability to just look at every user in a geographic area, they would lose some of those insights, but we would gain a lot of those protections. You know, Apple, they kind of show how, you know, you can have a lot of data about people, creepy amounts of data, but because they only store each individual's data separately, they can't comply with these dragnet warrants. Apple has dramatically oversold its privacy protections in the past. You know, they'll have these giant billboards that say, privacy, that's Apple. But the truth is, Apple has an entire law enforcement manual you can find online, which details the way that police can access nearly every form of data in your iCloud account. So your data from your device backup. So even if Apple won't help the FBI break into your iPhone, they'll hand over the iPhone backup that's stored on an iCloud server. They'll hand over messaging data. They'll hand over IP address data. They'll hand over so much data about how you're accessing the platform. Now, luckily, I think it was about a year ago, they introduced something called advanced data protection, something I want them to make a default, but right now you have to opt in. And this is one of the most powerful things that Apple users can do to protect their devices. So under advanced data protection, you get to hold the encryption keys for your iCloud account, not Apple. So by default, Apple is the one who holds the keys. So if they want to reset your password for you because you got locked out, great. If they want to reset it for the FBI or for, you know, the Texas Attorney General, not so great. And so with advanced data protection, they lose the ability to unlock your account and provide much of that data to law enforcement. And quite frankly, it's the only reason I have an Apple Watch. It's the only reason I feel comfortable using a lot of Apple products, because it's the only way to safely use those platforms. But you have to go through a couple of hoops to opt into it. And so that's something I encourage everyone to do.
I did not know about that. I'm learning a lot through this conversation. So just one last question. There are things we can do as individuals, things healthcare providers can do, things big tech companies can do, but we also need change at the legal level, you know, to offer us protection, because no matter what we do, the law can trump that. So is there one law or major change that you'd like to see in terms of the way that our privacy and data security is handled at the federal or state level?
Yeah, I mean, I literally have dozens I'm pushing, but the top one that I think is urgent to get passed right now is a ban on geofence warrants, keyword warrants, and police purchases of commercial data. Because one thing we didn't cover is that police have even more power to purchase our data than to seize it by force. And so this is a bill that we wrote in New York State that's been pending for a few years, Senate Bill 217. And I think next year it actually has a chance to pass, but we need to put pressure on lawmakers in New York to set an example for the country that police shouldn't be able to use the legal system to set these digital dragnets to track our search history, to track our location history, to track so much of what we do. And so, you know, we're calling on people, especially those in New York, but people everywhere in the country, to put pressure on lawmakers to get this bill passed. Because, you know, I'm really excited. We partnered with, you know, the ACLU to make this a model bill. And we've seen copycat bills starting to get introduced around the country. And if we start to make this the national model, we can push for a bill like this in DC as well. And I should say, this shouldn't be a partisan issue. You know, because while the use of geofence warrants and keyword warrants in abortion context may be very much a progressive concern and a Democratic concern, the truth is that we see a lot of Republicans that are really freaked out by the ability for the government to use these sorts of tools in other areas to target, you know, religious activity, to target political activity. I just think that across the political spectrum, no matter how divided we are right now, no matter how polarized, no matter how used we are to axiomatically assuming that what the other side believes will probably be a terrible idea, this should be one area where we can actually get through just a basic set of fundamental protections that really an overwhelming majority of Americans are going to support. And I would just be so grateful for any help people can give in calling lawmakers and calling leadership in Albany, particularly the Senate Majority Leader and the Assembly Speaker, and just calling for this bill to be enacted into law, S-217.
Well, thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Albert. It was a pleasure to have you here, and thank you for the important work that you're doing. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work?
Yes. No, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, for those of you who want to learn more about the different bills we're passing, the different lawsuits we're filing, or just the adorable puppies and kittens we have around the virtual office, also combating the surveillance state, it's stopspying.org, or we're also stopspyingny on your surveillance capitalism social media platform of choice.
Well, thanks again for your time. I really appreciate having you here, and I'll be sure to include links to all of that in the show notes.
Thank you again for having me.
Thank you for listening. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology, at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show.
You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Twitter and TikTok at Justin Lee Miller and Instagram at Justin J. Lee Miller. Also, be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. And if you have a question you'd like me to answer on a future episode of this show, you can leave me a podcast voicemail at speakpipe.com/sexandpsychology. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.